Welcome to The Apartment Guys, where we discuss all things apartment investing related, including how to find cash-flowing apartments and raise capital. Join us every week for high-level discussion and interviews that will take your investing to the next level. Now, here are your hosts, The Apartment Guys, John Prince and Tate Seamer.
All right. Welcome back. Another episode of The Apartment Guys podcast. We're doing something a little bit different again. We've got a little panel set up again that just like kind of our last episode with a few experts here that in the apartment building space that are going to share some wisdom and thoughts and ideas with you. And we're just going to kind of keep this really loose and free form. We've got a couple of friends. My business partner, Carl York, is here. And
hi,
he
everyone.
And I, how you doing, Carl?
Doing great.
Awesome to have you. Carl and I have been in business together for about 20 years in different endeavors and really love working together and have very different skill sets and whatnot. So we complement each other very well, and we'll talk maybe a little bit about that. But Mr. John Prince is here.
What's up, everybody?
As always, Mr. Apartment Guy.
It's going to be NC-17 today, so it's going to be a lot of editing.
Yeah. So anybody that knows of some profanity editing software, go ahead and shoot it to us, right? Emma Powell, we're going to keep it real for you.
I can't even talk. I'm too busy laughing.
This is just the beginning, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Emma, like Tate said, we're going to be just keeping it really casual today. So I met Emma 2 years ago.
Probably about 2 years ago.
She came to my office in Salt Lake, right?
Yep.
And I'm trying to even remember our discussion.
You told me to change my life calling.
Yeah, you weren't you looking into flipping houses or developing leads or something like
that
for flipping houses?
I started out doing single family lease options, and so I love to sell things on a lease option. I don't love buying on a lease option, but I was developing a business where I was doing that, and it was just maybe not the best fit for me.
And you were in some sort of franchise, weren't you?
Yeah.
And now today we were just talking before we got on. Emma's been totally kicking ass. She's gone from there to, what is this, 2 years later?
Yeah, just about, not quite 2 years.
She's got 92 units, 8 of her own, 50...
In a syndication.
And then she's got, a couple more in a JV. So
yeah, 34 more that we're closing in April in a joint venture.
Just goes to show you how much life can change in this business in 2 years.
Tony Robbins says we typically overestimate how much we can do in a year and underestimate how much we can do in 5 years.
I heard that quote for the first time the other day, and I thought, well, when I step back and look at what I've accomplished in the last year and a half, really, and then I heard Tony Robbins say that we overestimate what we can do in a year, and I thought, well, I just killed it this year. And just think about if I underestimate what I can do in 10 years, where I'm going to be in a decade. And that was really inspiring to me because I thought, well, I should probably 10x this plan here. I tend to be scared of the amount of work that's involved in doing something, and it gives me anxiety and I set lower goals because I'm trying to not bite off more than I can chew and work too hard and run too fast. And then I get into problems with my personal life when I do that. And so I tend to be afraid of doing that. And so I thought, oh, okay. Look what he just gave me permission to go after this huge goal in a decade.
So question, from where you were when we talked 2 years ago to where you are today, are you surprised with where you are today, or is this where you expected to be today in 2 years?
I have to think about.
Because I know we want to talk about mindset a little bit today.
Yeah.
And how that can be, you know, both a hindrance and, you know, a thing that helps you break through and in getting into this business. And so I'm just curious, are you ahead of where you expected to be? Or is this like, hey, I knew I was going to be here and I'm here?
Yes and no, because I think number of units is far higher than what I had set a goal to do. But at the same time, the monthly income and the cash flow is lower.
Gotcha.
So and that's probably the frustration. And when I look back and think, look at what I've accomplished over the last year and a half, has been, I have to stop and remind myself to look back, because these are more long-term projects. They're not like a flip or a wholesale where you're getting a payday. These are things where you're stretching out that income into the future. And so the cash flow has not been what I was anticipating, because I was doing a more of a transactionally based business where I would be pulling in assignment fees and commission, not commissions, but
wholesale fees,
but the spread on what I bought it for and what I sold it for. Right. And so I've been doing less of that. And so the cash flow has not caught up to where I was hoping it would be at this point.
Do you think that's going to change with this big 50 unit syndication you just closed on? Or is that taking into account that deal?
Yeah, I think that's more of a long-term play as well.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, that's another thing that's just interesting about syndication is not always, the cash flow won't always be, you know, maybe this huge amount that you might be thinking is, you know, you might end up being 10, 20%, whatever you are, mm-hmm. stake in the syndication. Yeah. But long-term, when you end up selling the asset, it can still be a huge payday. It can still be really good for you.
Yeah, on the front end, you're paying out your investors. We are collecting an acquisition fee, but it's not large, and we're splitting it between the three general partners. And so the cash flow will get better once we get a few more chunks of cash in after a refinance, a sale, those types of things. And then you can start investing those around, spreading it around a little bit, increasing cash flow. Right now, the biggest cash flow I have is from the 8 units that we own just as my husband and wife team that we have here.
Do you own those outright? Do you mind me asking?
No, we carry mortgages on them. So mm-hmm. our personal, we had a house that we lived in Texas that we basically hand rehabbed over the course of 2 years. And when we sold that, we had enough forced equity in it in the beginning, and then we lived in it for 5 years. So enough equity in it that I was able to when we moved to Utah, put a down payment on a personal home here in a HELOC. So we have no mortgage. We didn't have a mortgage on the Texas house either. We just had we refinanced out of the mortgage with a home equity loan because we added enough value. Mm-hmm. So when we paid that off, it was such a low interest rate, such a great loan that we walked away with a lot more net than we were expecting. And that is what has seeded the business. So we bought the personal home and the HELOC, and then we recycled that HELOC money to go and put down payments on other properties. And that's what seeded our sole properties. But it starts to eat you alive. We only have 8 units, a duplex, a couple single families and lease options, which are super easy to take care of management wise. And then a triplex. And I thought already the management of this is starting to be day-to-day too much. So, and then you eventually run out of money, even though you're trying to burr it. You maybe leave 10 grand or 20 grand or 30 grand behind in a property, and because you can't refinance it back out, you're going to run out of money. And so I told my husband, I said, I'm going to run out of money. And I...
is the worst.
Yeah.
Who here has run out of money in the last year?
So he's a W-2 guy. He keeps the lights on, and then I'm using that stash of cash that we made off selling that house to go and buy properties. And I said, I'm going to have to slow down the rate at which I'm acquiring properties because I'm running out of money and I don't know how to get partners or how to use other people's money. And I have Dave Ramsey mindset problems with doing that. And he said, look, you are going to have to figure out a way that you can go do a deal with zero of your own money. And I said, well, you have to go bigger. That's a large project. There has to be enough meat on the bone to feed everybody. And so that was the mindset shift right there, his challenge. I have not done it yet. I still have put some of my own money in every deal that I've been in. But that challenge is dangled in front of me as a joke between the two of us that eventually I need to do a large deal for $0. And I don't just mean zero at the end of the refinance. I mean literally zero. So that's a goal that I'm having right now. And he's the one who challenged me to do that. And then at dinner the other day, somebody said, well, how many units do you own? Okay, we're closing in on 100 here pretty soon. And she said, well, how many do you want to own? And he said, oh, probably 1,000. I said, wait, what? We have a goal for 1,000 doors? He said, well, 100 wasn't that hard. Why don't we just do 1,000? And I thought, okay, so he has been a great source of support. I never had to go through that phase of your friends and family telling you you couldn't do something. And he's been pushing me to think bigger this whole time. I don't know if he realizes how much he's done that, because he just throws that out there like it's easy, and then I have to go figure out how to make it work.
I'll tell you what I'm thinking while you're talking too, is that even if you don't have the cash flow necessarily that you want right now as far as where you thought you'd be mm-hmm. in 2 years, just think how much you've gained as far as reputation, as far as like just education.
Yeah.
Experience. I mean, you basically have gotten a master's degree in the last 2 years in multifamily by doing these deals. You have a ton of education. Like I said, the last time I saw you was 2 years ago when we met in my office. And then I started seeing your stuff on Facebook, closing 50 unit deals and putting more, like, you know, 50 unit deals under contract. And I thought, whoa, she has just absolutely gone gangbusters. And so even not even having talked with you at all in the last 2 years, my perception was just like, whoa, Emma Powell is like destroying
something it. Changed.
And so just think about that credibility that you have, probably not even knowing it in the community now too, where you go out and get a deal now and people are like, Emma Powell, they know who you are. They've seen that you're doing big things. And so you already have this instant increased credibility just from getting out there and hustling.
And so. As difficult as this 50 unit deal has been to close, because we closed in, I think, 3 weeks ago, and it's going to be a beast to rehab as well, but it was much more difficult to close than we anticipated. And so we often said in the partnership, we have to close this because this is a big public deal that we're working on and we need it for credibility and to ride the momentum. And so definitely that is a factor. I would never want to let something like that cause us to do a deal that wasn't worth doing just to get something under your
belt.
Just
for the sake of closing on a deal, obviously.
Yes,
yeah.
So I am a big believer in base hits. I think, I know Tate and I've talked about this before and we have maybe a little different opinions on it, but there's a lot of deal shaming that goes along in the real estate community because we all want to be able to come and talk about the deal of the decade and how we did this. What I'm talking about is when you're talking about the best deal that you've ever done or one that you're really excited about because it's atypical, does that mean that you're not going to do your bread and butter deals? Those are your base hits. And so we're all looking for that amazing deal that we can go to a RIA or a group and say, oh, I did this. And be, oh, where'd you get that deal? And become this deal rock star. And sometimes we forget that there are base hits that we need to accomplish, the steady deals that butter the bread, keep the lights on. And I feel like those, you should never do a deal that's not a deal, but only having to do a deal because you want that deal prestige or to avoid deal shaming gets in people's heads. And sometimes I think that they don't realize that base hits are what you build those bigger deals on.
It helps with your personal, at least for me, I have a very much the same mindset where when I get a deal done, for example, we're going to close on a deal today. And there's
congratulations.
Yes, thank you.
Yay.
We're all Let's pretty celebrate excited. That for yeah. I mean, and I would say this is probably a single, maybe, you know, we could like maybe a double, but probably a single.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just a mental boost in energy that comes from like, okay, I'm getting this deal done. It's off the books. And it's almost like a domino that falls to my other deals. Whereas, you know, when your deals fall out of contract, let's say, you know, you get it, you do spend a lot of work on an apartment deal. You do all the due diligence and then it falls out of contract. It's almost like you're not getting that first domino to fall. And so mentally you're going into the next deal with almost like, is this one going to fall through too? And so to your point, you don't just do a deal for the sake of doing a deal, but I do experience there's almost that boost in energy from checking off a box. Okay. Mm-hmm. I got a single done.
Yeah.
And so now it's like, I'm going into my next deal knowing, okay, I got that one done and I'm going into this one with even more confidence knowing that like, hey, I'm going to close this deal and I'm going to get through whatever obstacles there are to close this deal. So I just think as far as like personally building your confidence, there's something about just getting deals done.
Yeah. Another big thing into that Tate and I are finding now is that we have
your mic.
Oh, my mic. Thank you. Is that closing deals, most sellers are concerned with who they're selling to. Somebody can come to the table and actually close a deal. So there is a lot more than just the base hit there. The base hit's great. So I think acknowledging that is worthwhile, but also the ability to say that we've never not closed a deal that we got under contract on, or at least we never had one that failed because of us. Maybe the deal failed because the numbers didn't work, but being able to come to the table and say we close deals is a big thing. And we've already found that we've gotten
fail because you don't have the resources.
And not just bullshitting, but you actually do close deals.
Yes, yes,
you know,
we do.
Mm-hmm. So you have that confidence behind the statement.
So that really does bring your confidence up a lot and your ability to speak to that.
So Emma, your share was amazing in terms of where you came from a year and a half ago, meeting with John, having him give you, quote, permission to do what you wanted to do, set some high goals, or... And this is there's a few things to unpack here in your share. One really practical kind of takeaway, because our listeners are looking for a lot of times, how do I get started, mm-hmm. right? How do I get started in this business? And not everybody has this, but if you have equity in your home, freeing up that equity with a home equity line of credit can be an incredible boost and source of capital that gives you the ability to put down earnest money deposits, gives you the ability to do due diligence in the case of multifamily, travel where you need to travel to check out your assets. And Carl, you and I have built our business on home equity line of credit.
We started it with credit lines. With that money, yeah. And to what you were just saying is that we're using that same money right now on due diligence and earnest money. So if you have that equity, loosen it up. Yeah. There's no better way to finance anything really than a home equity line of credit, because it revolves, you pay it down, you move it back up, and usually they're 10 to 15 year notes. So
there's a lot of fear about borrowing against your home to do that, and I find that it's a house.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one. Do your best if you can, but don't let that fear of losing your home. I find that people are very attached emotionally to the concept of a home and losing your home. And I feel like I wouldn't do this if I felt like I was going to lose my home. But at the same time, the fear of losing your home is forefront in a lot of people's minds, why they're afraid to tap into that home equity.
I can speak to that a little too, because we've had to deal with that a little bit in figuring out what would really have to happen for you to lose your home if you had a home equity line of credit and you had a property that they're really just a job. They're a deal. And when we were flipping, it was like, well, we're going to be in and out of it in 6 months. If for some reason it didn't work out and we went into deficit a little bit, had to hold on to that money in the loan, like that balance. But it would have to go really far for you to actually lose your house. You'd have to have several deals go south in a row. So, you know, you kind of have to look at it like that. It's not as dangerous as you think. You're buying a solid property. It's got value. But you might lose $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 on a property, but you're always going to get your next one's going to make up for that. And we all know that.
You can cannibalize the HELOC to pay itself in bad times. So it does take a long time.
You can hold a balance too.
Specifically for apartment buildings, since we are the apartment guys, right? And gals today, you've got, when you're working on deals, if you're serious about deals, you're traveling to the markets that you're shopping in. If you find a good deal, you're traveling to check it out. There's costs involved with that. There's earnest money costs. There's attorney's costs. There's due diligence costs. There's loan fees, all of which are expenses that come before closing. And so having something like a HELOC available to fund those things is a wonderful thing to have in your pocket. Now, if you don't have that available to you, find a partner that does. That's what this is. This is a team sport. And your resourcefulness is your greatest strength. And I think all four of us here sitting at the table here are where we are and doing what we're doing largely because we're very resourceful people and we know where to go get what we need. And a lot of times that starts with asking somebody else where to go and getting advice from them. You say that's true, Emma?
That's how I closed this 50 unit. I went through a couple of potential partners who were interested in it because the numbers were good, but not the right fit to fill in where my lack was, and we weren't able to pull it together. And so I my big thing when I'm networking is to understand what each person does so that when I get an opportunity or a problem, I know who to call. And as we were talking about before you started with the interview, the deal where I did not do that, the one that got away because I didn't exercise my network appropriately. But the 50 unit, I was struggling with a particular aspect of it, and I brought it to somebody that I knew who did that and had that skill set. And he came back and he underwrote it and he said, I think this is a great deal. Your numbers, I fixed them up a little bit here and there, but overall, I think it's a great deal. Do you need the capital to do this? I think I have the capital for it. I said, yes. He said, you need a partner? Yes, let's bring it in. And his perseverance and ability to be able to work with the situation and fill in our strengths and weaknesses are very complementary. And that's how I closed that deal, was just knowing who to call when I would run into roadblocks or when I had an opportunity I knew was in their alley.
Perfect. And another, just the power of leveraging other people's experience, other people's knowledge, other people's resources. That's what this game is it's leverage. And it's like I said, a team sport where you need people. And if you're the kind of solopreneur that needs to work on your own, this may not be the space probably is not the space for you. One other thing that you really did a beautiful job of describing was your relationship with your husband, and in particular, how he not only supports you, but challenges you and gives you the confidence in the direction of where you need, almost helps you refocus in some ways, like on where you need to be headed and what you need to be doing. It seems to me like having that in place with your significant other, where you're basically not only paddling in the same direction, but in, you know, enthusiastically being there together. Being a single guy, I've never had that experience, but it sounds like it would be quite a powerful thing.
I just read a quote. I'm going to interject here.
Yeah.
I just read a quote from Warren Buffett that said, I think it was like one of his top three decisions is who you marry. I think he said it was like the most important. He said, I think it was other than like your business. It was like the most important decision in life because it affects everything you do. And so having a partner like you to that point that really is paddling in the same direction is huge.
Yeah. What really illustrates that is when things are not going well. So I've had a couple of blows this last year and a half, some financial losses, some of them due to me being a little too eager and putting down earnest money before I had really allowed my team to vet the deal out. And another where we were, it's a long story, but we lost a significant amount of money in a business loan that we made. And when I lost the earnest money, I was sitting there thinking, no, I can fix this. I can pull this out of the bag. I can call some more people. I can make this work. I don't want to talk to my husband about it until I can call him and let him know that I have a solution to it. And immediately when that thought popped into my head, that when you want to start hiding these kinds of things, that is the moment that you pick up the phone. And so I called him at work and I said, I'm embarrassed. I'm upset. I needed to tell you that I've lost this amount of money because I put earnest money down on a deal that turned out to not be a deal. The first words out of his mouth were, it's okay. I know you can make it back.
That's great.
I told this story to somebody close to me. And she said, that is not what would have come out of my husband's mouth. So him being able to be as chill as he is and let things ride, and he doesn't have to understand every nuance and detail of my business. He just has to have confidence in me that I can make back, even losing a significant amount of money last year. I have made 10 times that in potential income with these deals that we have that'll be closed or will be refinancing and closing over the next couple of years.
And that's another thing in that is that you have to make a few mistakes along the way. Luckily only earnest money, right? So learn
on one of them.
On one of them. Right, okay. But you will make mistakes and you don't want to focus too much on that, but you do want to learn from each one. So, you know, having that ability as well and making a few hopefully smaller mistakes.
Lessons that we've learned, not only making the mistakes, but the communication and the relationship that we've had to have with each other has only carried over to benefit the business. So when you're reading a book like Crucial Conversations and you're having that conversation in your marriage, or nonviolent communication are two top ones that have really changed our lives as a couple, that only spills out to when you're having conversations with other people, when you're negotiating deals, when you have business partners and you hit hiccups. That relationship at home sets the stage and the framework for all of the business relationships and especially partnerships that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had a thought and I wonder what you guys think about this. Once you start playing in this apartment game, it's a little different. You know, a lot of people come from flipping houses to kind of get, or something single family house related to getting into the apartment game. That's a common pathway. And so it's a little different. Whereas when you're flipping houses or wholesaling houses, you can afford to take a loss often and make it up with other houses. But this game is, since it's a bigger game, I do think that while you do need to always have this mentality of like just taking action, I do think you need to do it in a much more careful way because you're playing a much bigger game. And so I guess what I mean by all that is to say that you should be taking action and just plowing forward. That's the best way, and you're going to make mistakes. But you do need to take extra precaution, in my opinion, when you're starting to play in this apartment game to really mitigate risk as much as possible, because a loss on an apartment deal can oftentimes, you know, set you back much worse than just a loss like on a flip, where maybe I'm going to lose 20 grand on this flip. So I don't know what your guys' thoughts on that are.
I actually find a little bit of the opposite, because you have the economies of scale when you're working with this number of doors. So you can make a really big mistake with apartment A, you learn from it, and apartment B, you don't make that mistake because you have 90 of them to go through and learn these on. And so while the little mistakes do add up quickly, it does allow you a lot more time in the sandbox to make those mistakes And if they're smaller mistakes, the same way you would be doing when you're flipping a house, it really is not magnified throughout the entire deal. And so I agree with what you're saying, but at the same time, the economy of scale will bail you out on a lot of the smaller mistakes.
John, I think what you said is perfect. And I think where the rubber meets the road is in your underwriting, obviously.
Yeah.
And our mentor, Corey Peterson, is a very conservative underwriter. He doesn't like to see large rent bumps in year one or even year two. He doesn't like to see, you know, vacancy rates going from 50% to 10% in a year. You know, those are and you know, things like exit cap rates, where you can really get your rents to, like, you're getting real about your rent comps and being real about where you can get your net operating income. Those are all things, you know, that those are all places that one number can throw things pretty sideways. And because of the scale, because of the economy of scale, if you make a $100 mistake 50 times on your NOI, that's a big, big difference in value of a property and cash flow, right?
Another angle on that is that with a single family flip, you're usually yourself or your partner, but now you've got generally a lot more people, bigger investors. You don't want to make mistakes that really are going to affect the bottom line a ton, because you have those investors you have to pay off who are involved and you're responsible for. So, you know, you want to watch your P's and Q's as much as you can, spreadsheets especially.
Yeah, it really is in the spreadsheet. It's the devil's in the details. And, you know, for those of you starting out, you can expect to probably look at least 100 deals and probably underwrite half of those or a third of those before you're going to find that needle in a haystack that pencils the way that we would want to see it pencil, and that somebody like Corey would want to see it pencil, where you're looking for cash flow out of the gate, you're looking for profitability, and you're looking for a nice back end where you're increasing the value of the property quite a bit or some, and doing what's obviously what we call a value add or forced appreciation. So really, you know, we love to talk about the magic of multifamily and why it's so amazing. Emma, you already talked a little bit about why you're in multifamily. We mentioned economies of scale. Yeah, I just want to dig a little bit further with you into what can you say to the person out there that's listening that is saying, you know, it sounds great. Apartment buildings sound amazing. Passive cash flow sounds amazing. Of course, wealth sounds awesome. I don't have money. I don't have time. What do you say to somebody like that? That's, you've gone from where you were thinking those things in the recent past, right? To some degree. Yeah.
Or maybe not saying that this is the reason why I'm not going to do this, but it was an obstacle that I had to figure out how to overcome. So rather than just saying, I don't have money, I don't have time, I quit, it was acknowledging I have some limitations here and being creative about how to get around those. And the word that jumps to mind is education. The more you know about something, the less risky the endeavor is going to be. And so if you go into something not knowing what you're talking about or not what you're doing, you're going to get taken advantage of. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to underwrite things improperly. I think in the single family world, we're all familiar with the role of the hard money lender as the second pair of eyes, who is more experienced than you are. You bring him a deal. You say, can you lend on this? And he says, here's what I think it'll sell for. Here are the comps I pulled for it. And they just help you to underwrite it. And you're going to learn from that experience and have that person. In multifamily, it's no different. You're going to bring it to people who can find your holes and be able to tell you what's going on. And so the next time you go into it, you think, oh, I remember the last time I underwrote this and this owner didn't put all the capital expenditures in their operating budget, and that made it skewed the numbers out, or they put their debt in there. And I remember the last time I saw this, that this is how we handled it. So you're able to make decisions in a way that you are confident in because you have educated yourself both by research and by experience. Your risk goes down significantly, and you are associating with people who have overcome the problems that you've had with no money, no time, whatever, and they give you ideas, and you're able to take a hodgepodge of all these best ideas, best practices, and put them all in one place in your own business. People have trod this path before you. any excuse you have, any difficulty you have is not new. Go out and find the solution to it, because somebody out there is podcasting about it, putting it on YouTube, blogging about it, talking about it at conferences. The more you educate yourself, the more you're going to come across. But that has to be tempered with only educating and never doing. You cannot learn to play the piano out of a book.
So you got the specialized knowledge. You've got the business plan in place, right? You've got some marketing systems. And by that, I mean your networking and you're finding deals and finding money, right? Let's talk about the mindset piece for a second, because I think that's the hardest thing for anybody, is overcoming and surmounting that belief, that the self-limiting talk that's in our heads. I think we all have it, you know, to a certain degree, and it's something that we all deal with, and the successful amongst us master it. So you've obviously achieved some success here recently, and for me that points at an inner game, if you will, that you're having some success with as well. Can you speak maybe to how mindset is different today than even 6 months ago or a year ago?
I feel like in a lot of ways I've gone backwards in the mindset, because when you first start out on the journey, you don't know what you don't know. And especially someone like me, I'll research. And when I feel like I've gotten to the end of that road, I pull the trigger and jump in. There's only so much that you can learn by researching, and you eventually have to do. So suddenly I'm leaping off the cliff, and I know that about myself. And I thought, I have a good mindset. I take on these projects and I am confident that I can accomplish these things. And then the more you spend time with people who are talking about mindset, the more you realize that this is something that maybe you struggle with. And this is maybe something that you have some things to weed out and some demons that you need to tackle that you were in complete denial about when you started the journey. And so here I am a year and a half later, suffering from imposter syndrome and recognizing things in my own mindset that were completely blind spots, and recognizing there are more blind spots that I haven't even identified yet. So I'm really feeling right now in the dumps about the mindset, mostly because the awareness has increased.
Can you explain imposter syndrome a little bit more for those who might not be completely familiar with that?
Well, if you're a woman, you're familiar with it. It's basically when you are doing something and you are having initial success, but you really don't believe that you are an expert yet, and that you are going out and doing things and representing yourself in a way that might not be completely accurate. Because if they only knew how disorganized you were, or how much you're still learning, or how much before you do something you have to Google it. It's something that a lot of people do. New people, women tend to do it in general a little bit longer than men. And you'll notice when you see it in yourself and in others, when you are introduced to somebody and they tell you what they do and they say, their body language, the shrugs, that I'm just starting out, I'm just learning, and then you find out they have 34 apartments. Something like that. Some people cannot see what they're accomplishing, and they always are comparing themselves to people who are bigger than they are, better than they are, and they're never going to arrive with that mindset. You have to, if that's something that you struggle with, which I would say the majority of the people I talk to struggle with that, especially at the beginning of a journey, you have to purposefully root it out. It will not go away on its own.
Here's my thought on this subject. I want everyone's feedback on this, because this is kind of what my life experience has taught me so far. In this real estate game, everyone's always trying to make themselves look bigger than they are, right? Or at least it's common for people to really, you know, you see what they're doing on Facebook. You never see like the icky underside, but we all know that it's kind of there. And so what I've learned is that the best thing to do is typically just be honest with the people that you're dealing with about what kind of investor you are, where you're at in your process. And they're going to usually find it out anyways, once they get past a couple of surface level conversations with you, you know, where you're really at. And so it just seems to have worked out better for me, because I have that personality to always try and make myself look bigger than I am. And so I'm always trying to tell myself, you know what, whether it's I'm doing a big development deal and I'm talking to a buyer and I don't want to seem like, you know, I'm a new developer. I just am trying really consciously right now just to tell people exactly where I'm at. You know, this is my first or second deal at like this. And this is, you know, just give them just an honest accounting of who I am and what kind of investor I am. And it just, I don't know, it seems to work out better for me. I just wonder what you guys think about that. Is it better to just be honest about, you know, you as who you are as an investor? Or is it better to try and make yourself look bigger than you are?
So I'll throw this question back out to the three of you, because we were having this conversation before we started recording about the deal that I lost. A deal in Salt Lake City that was nearly an 8-cap deal for over 100 units. And I was very excited about this deal and I had the confidence that I could close it. But due to maybe some over transparency with the broker, he urged them to go with another offer. And I feel like I got strung along a little bit for a couple of weeks to a month while they were waiting for this other offer to come in writing. And so I feel like there's a balance between overrepresenting yourself and transparency that is difficult to strike. And just for you guys, put that out there. What are your thoughts on how to be transparent but also confident simultaneously?
With a broker?
Never.
All bets are off.
You are the biggest fish in that sea.
Always be as pro as you can.
Yeah, I mean, you want the deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you didn't get the deal because of, like you said, maybe over transparency, right? Like, you don't have to tell somebody your credit history and, you know, your psychological history and, you know, what you feel like your weaknesses are and aren't. And like, you want to go in there knowing, like you said, you knew you could close that deal, right? And what you did was, subconsciously, in my opinion, what you did was you sabotaged it.
I did, right? Because I was afraid of the amount of work it would take to close that deal.
Right.
Because that's something that I recognize over the last year and a half that has come out of my mindset journey.
Yeah.
That's something I need to face.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think it's, just a great opportunity for you to take a look at what, you know, why did I do that? What's the limiting belief that's maybe operating in some blind spot that's calling the shots, making you think and say things that aren't in your favor, right? In my opinion, my personal opinion, to get back to your question about transparency versus overrepresenting, there we go, yourself. I think for me, I don't ever say anything to anybody that I don't know I can back up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that said, I will make the assessment that I can back up a lot of things, if that makes sense. In other words, I don't mind telling somebody that, yes, this is something that's new for me or for us in our trajectory as a business, but we're going to make it happen. And and here's how we're going to make it happen. The transparency goes a long way. People love transparency, and it's a wonderful thing. And brokers in particular want transparency, but more than that, they want to hear you say you're going to close a deal, and they want to get that feeling from you. And this is a little bit of a drawn out answer, but my thought on this is represent reality, but believe in yourself to the point that you know that you can create realities that maybe you haven't created yet.
Can we put that on a t-shirt?
hashtag. I like the way you said that, because you're right. I mean, I think you said it perfectly, because you don't want to represent something that you can't back up.
Yeah.
But you need to have enough confidence in yourself, and this is probably getting back to mindset. You need to be doing the work to have enough confidence that you're doing all the little things that, yeah, I can go out and get this thing closed. I can go out and raise the money for this. And so you don't need to necessarily disclose that I have to do a raise or I have to do this, you know, like you talked about, right?
The death spell with a broker is I have to do a raise. Ever say that.
And the truth is, that wasn't even an accurate statement.
Yeah.
Because you didn't have to do a raise. You could have called a syndicator and had them do the raise.
That's true. And that's what we're talking about, the creative problem solving and knowing who to call. That's a perfect
example. Well, and it just gets right back to leveraging yourself with other people's experience, right? Because I know that I can walk into a $5 or $10 million apartment building deal and confidently say, we're going to get this closed. I've got the sponsor. I've got the net worth. I've got the liquidity. I've got the resume. And we're going to get this done. And that's because I've affiliated myself and aligned myself with somebody in the space that legit can get all that stuff done.
What do you say when you maybe sidestepping your lane a little bit? Let's say you're focusing on multifamily and you get a storage unit, a mobile home park, or an assisted living opportunity that you feel like you want to follow. At what point have you associated with the people who can help you close a deal like that? Or do you just bypass those to say, I don't know how to close that. I probably could, but I need to stay in my lane.
Stay in your lane is my thought on this, is you got to pick one thing and do it well. And especially now, everybody is niched in this space, and to compete and do this at a high level, you need to be, if it's self-storage, do self-storage. I think self-storage is an amazing way to go. I've been a little tempted by it, to be honest, recently even. But if we were going to do that, we would change our business model, right? We wouldn't make an exception to our current business model and put our resources towards something that's not moving us towards our long-term goals, right?
Yeah, and if we were to step in that direction, we would make sure we did plenty of research first before stepping in that direction if it were to happen simultaneously. So, but yeah, keeping your niche is a great thing. We've had a 2-year period where we've done 3 different types of deals all at the same time, and you want to avoid that feeling like you're running around too much and you're trying to learn too much at once. So stay in the niche. You can learn lots, but if you're learning in one niche, it's much easier than trying 2 or 3.
And you can decide to, I mean, like there's people like Neil Bawa who do, I mean, he does, they're, I know that I've seen that they're sending out storage unit deals, and they also do
new
big multifamily syndication. So maybe for him, that's part of his niche. He feels like that it's not too different. But I do agree with the overall sentiment of what everyone's saying, and that's that you need to be hyper-focused on what it is you do and do that well. Because, I mean, I know even, like I have, I'm sure most of us in here have our licenses, our agent's licenses. And I've had like 2 or 3 things this year where people wanted me to represent them, and it would have been an easy buck. But I just said, nope, I'm passing that off to someone I know, because I just don't need to be spending time on that. I don't do that. That's not a part of my business model. And I don't need, and then those little things, you know, maybe to make a $7,000 commission end up taking so much time. And so, you know, and that's just one example. It could be anything. It could be something, anything besides that, that's not a part of what you do. So I agree with the idea that you need to pick what you do. You need to be very deliberate about what you do. And if you do that, and if you're focused on that, I think in the end, you'll make a lot more money.
Well, this comes up a lot for beginners, and something that I am still facing as a relative beginner. When we're talking about mindset and confidence, confidence comes from competence. And so if you are good at what you do, then you will be confident that you can repeat that. And so at a certain point, being able to focus and niche down and become really good at something, at least for a period of time, you might be able to sidestep out of your lane a little bit to maybe a slightly unrelated asset class, because it's not that much different than what you've done over and over. But to be doing that at the beginning before you really feel like you can drive competently in your lane, it breeds that sense of unconfidence. That's not really a word.
Which leads to that sense of being an imposter, right?
Yes.
If you are doing something that you're not really clear about, right?
And you really haven't gotten good at the step before. And I'm not saying that you need to do single family to do multifamily. I'm not saying you need to do residential in order to do commercial. Pick the thing you're going for and go for it. But make sure that you spend an adequate amount of time going for that before you do something that is slightly out of that lane.
Yeah, and I would say this, that personally, I don't have any interest in being outside of the lane. We had a single family opportunity come up recently that was, I mean, it was a heavy lift. It was a big job. But at the end of the day, you got to ask yourself, is this moving me closer to my long-term goals? Which speaks to the importance of having long-term goals, right? So, which kind of leads me to a question that we can maybe kind of start to wrap this up with, is Emma Powell in 5 years, what's it look like?
all those passive investors that I'm trying to reach to invest in my deals in 5 years, that's me. You can all call me when you need money for a deal. And not only that, but I'll have the experience to be able to not only be a limited partner in your deal, but I would also be able to be the key partner with the experience and the net worth and the liquidity to sign on your loan and make sure that your project stays on the rails. That is my goal. 100% passive income with a little bit of babysitting, the machine every once in a while, push the merry-go-round as it starts to slow down. So I'm not saying that passive income is a real thing. It does take some work, but to be able to have most of my income derived from those types of activities as a limited partner and a key partner.
Yeah. I expect to see you with a gold chain.
Gold chain with a dollar sign.
I just want to see you walking around with a big gold chain.
And gold teeth?
Yeah.
I would just be happy with an upgrade from my minivan.
Do you have a amount of passive cash flow in mind? Just curious. I'd just like to...
Per month, year?
Yeah, per month.
$10,000 a month is stop number one, and then it will go from there. But stop number one is where our lifestyle will make a significant shift.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like to, over the next 2 to 3 years, get to the point where we're putting at least $50,000 to $100,000 a year into somebody else's deal. And so after 5 years of doing that, it will bring back to us that we are now by and large passive investors, and our active deals will take a back seat to that. We'll be doing less and less deals as deal sponsors and more deals as key partners.
Awesome.
That's great.
Well, this has been great. We've hit on some really cool stuff, I think, here, from the power of partnership to the power of cheap money with HELOCs to the power of doing one thing and doing it well. We could probably take this and make 3 different podcasts out of it. But so, Emma, thank you so much for being a guest on The Apartment Guys, even though you're not a guy.
I'm from Washington, so we say you guys to mean girls all the time. It's okay.
You guys, yeah. So, yeah, with that, I think we'll just sign off, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, you.
Emma. Thanks, Emma.
You've been listening to The Apartment Guys. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play to get new weekly episodes and to drop us a review. For more, please follow us on Instagram and Facebook or visit our website at apartmentguyspodcast.com. Until next time, take massive action steps and rock on.